simulation. Okay, so I don't really need to go over this. We're all here. We're all experts on the direct detection. So I'm going to be focusing on this portion. I'm not really going to be so concerned with the local variation in density. I'm mostly focusing on the velocity structure. And this is this G-min function that we've already heard about from Neil and others. So just as a pointer here, I'm actually including the 4 pi b squared in my definition of f of b. Right. So as I mentioned before, I'm going to be mostly, in the first two parts of the talk, focusing on the Via Láctea simulation. I think most of you guys have probably seen movies of this before, but I thought I'd show one. Anyways, one I've made more recently myself. Whoops. This is just a movie of the formation of the halo in this case. So these are cosmological simulations, just dark matter particles. We're just ignoring gas physics completely. This is just showing the time evolution, and there's all this familiar substructure, these clumps that we've heard, the larger of which would be hosting dwarf galaxies, and so providing substructure both in configuration space, but also it's hard to see in this kind of a visualization because it's just density. There's lots of velocity space structure too. So I'm just going to interrupt this movie here. Well, there's a zoom in around, but you've guys seen movies like this in the past, and show you one more movie, which is a visualization. Now, this is not time dependent. This is just at redshift zero. It's sort of a zoom around in the central region of the simulation. So I think this is about 50 kiloparsecs or so, and showing some of the velocity structure we see. So this is still a spatial distribution, but it's highlighted according to phase-based density. The colors represent phase-based density, so that sort of shows you some of the colder streams that we see. So there's all these subhalos, and you can see there's clearly tidal streams that are just the disruption, arise from the disruption, tidal disruption of dark matter subhalos. And these, of course, have the potential to show up as interesting velocity structure in the local distribution. As I mentioned, this is a pretty large scale here, 50 kiloparsecs, so these are not necessarily the same kind of structure that we would expect to see in the central regions at 8 kiloparsecs. And it's also harder to resolve there, of course, numerically. No, I don't think so. I could, but maybe I should. Yeah, that visualization actually was done by people at the national labs where the simulation was run, so at Oak Ridge National Lab. Right. So that's all I'm going to say about the simulations. Ask me if you want to know more. There's not just Via Láctea. We also have the G-Halo series. So there's at least 2 billion particle simulations with particle masses of about 1,000 solar masses, or Via Láctea 2 is 4,000 solar masses. And more recently, we've been trying to run an even larger simulation, what we dubbed Silver River, but with the available computational time we've had, we've only been able to push this to redshift 6, so it's not really useful yet for looking at dark matter structure in the Milky Way today.
How much?
This is taken about roughly 5 million CPU hours. So these are expensive. To push this down to redshift zero, we probably need 20 million more. So I don't know. Right. Okay, so I'm going to talk about velocity structure. And I already mentioned these tidal interactions that strip off material. Here's just a visualization of this from Via Láctea 1, actually following the orbit of a subhalo through the host halo potential, and you can just made fits to the three-dimensional mass distribution of the subhalos, and you can see that the major axis orients itself towards the galactic center as it orbits. That's a good indication that tidal forces are important. They're sort of reorienting the halo. And as it's passing through a pericenter passage, it loses a lot of mass due to tidal stripping, usually from the outside in, as we also heard about in a talk yesterday. Here's just some plots of the orbits of a variety of subhalos that we follow throughout the simulation. So some of them undergo many pericenter passages, others only undergo one, or this one's on first infall, actually. And then associated with that, you have this is mass now as a function of time. As you can see, at the first pericenter passage, they lose a lot of mass. And then at subsequent pericenter passages, sometimes they'll lose a bit more. And so this just goes to show that subhalos do undergo tidal interactions and lose material. So in some work I did back in 2009 and 2010 that Neil Weiner was also involved in, we were looking at the velocity distribution functions that result in the Via Láctea simulations. So now this I'm showing here on the left side, the halo rest frame, F of B, and on the right, move to the Earth's rest frame in summer. And so, of course, you have different ways of sampling the particle distribution. So one thing that is typically done is just to use all particles in a spherical shell at 8 kiloparsec. And that's what's shown here in this red line. And then for comparison, the best fit Maxwellian, which is this dotted line. And so you can immediately see there's a pretty big discrepancy. And this is not the first time this was seen. Steen Hansen showed this in 2005, and Mark Fogelsberger found this in the Aquarius simulations about a year before we did. But we recover these same kind of departures, namely global, sort of a deficit here, and then an excess here, and then actually you can't see it on this linear scale, but it drops down below the standard Maxwellian again. And then what we focused on in this analysis was the departures from that in spatial localization. So in addition to just using a spherical shell sample, we also plopped down a whole bunch of sample spheres that each had a radius about 1.5 to 2 kiloparsecs and contained within them 20 to 30,000 particles. And so we could make distribution functions or FFV functions just for the samples in those little sample spheres. We had 100 sample spheres that were all at 8 kiloparsecs. And they're distributed in a spherical shell. And so the shaded region showed this, the departure from the spherical shell average due to these individual halos and due to these individual sample spheres. So you can see there's additional departures that occur only in a few of these sample spheres. So these are spatially localized features. So in some cases here, you have discrete spikes due to the presence of either a subhalo or a tidal stream. So this is kind of interesting. It's not common. It doesn't happen all the time. It's only in a sort of occasional. And of course, this is limited because we only have, in this case, these are 1.5 kiloparsecs spheres. And of course, what's really relevant is the structure on Earth radii. So we can't directly address that, so you have to do some extrapolation if you want to know how this actually behaves at the smallest scales. But the departures, there's clear departures from a Maxwellian distribution. That's just saying that the halo is not completely relaxed. Violent relaxation, if it happened, didn't completely wipe out all the information and hasn't completely reshuffled all the orbits. And then again, there's these local departures. So I thought I'd just show on this plot what the various experiments that we're talking about, what ranges they're kind of considering, because of course not all experiments have the same sort of velocity sensitivity. So here's just a table of just some experimental benchmarks, CDMS with germanium, CDMS with silicon, xenon, DAMA, cogent, crest, and of course I have to pick, if I want to convert the recoil energies that they report in their papers to some velocity, I also need to assume something about the mass of the particle that's scattering, so I'm exploring a few different ones here, 50, 100, 500, and so on. And then, of course, there's all these low-energy samples that are matched to cogent that we just heard about from Patty Fox, so I'm just taking from their papers the same recoil energies. So every one of the experiments has a low-energy correspondence, where it's just, as we just heard, just matched directly to the cogent annual modulation signal that has been reported. So if I just overplot that here, you can see what ranges of velocities we're actually talking about. So there's two bars that refer to the lower energy and upper energy of recoil energy that they're reporting signals in or limits in. And then, of course, it can extend to even higher energy. That's why these bars continue. But you can see for some of the experiments here, you're covering most of the entire distribution function. And for some of the experiments, like, for example, these light dark matter ones, 7 to 10 GeV, you're really sampling more of the high velocity tail. This is all for elastic scattering, no inelastic. So for inelastic, the trend would be to push these to higher velocities. Cogent is this one. So all these have been, this is what Patty Fox was showing, and also Neil before, is that you can just convert all these different experiments to the same V-min range. So that's why all these are at the same range. Okay, so this is the sort of velocity range we're talking about. You can also just take these same samples and convert them to a modulation fraction and also a peak day. And so you can see this is what people have been referring to. Here is a look at modulation fraction. So now I'm starting the plot at 400, sort of what's relevant for these low-energy interpretations. And so you can see it starts at about 15 or 10 to 20%, and then it rises, of course, as you get to out further onto the tail. You can have a larger relative difference between winter and summer. And so the Maxwellian is this dotted line, so it reaches 100% modulation only at very high V-mins. And so now I'm plotting this as a function of V-min, not as a function of velocity, of course. And then you can see the departures both in this spherical shell sample and also, it's maybe a little bit hard to see, but in this thin black line, I'm plotting one particular sample sphere, so the behavior of one particular sample sphere. And so you can see the modulation fraction can, in some cases, go up and down and then rise again. So it's just a function of the actual distribution of velocities in that particular local sample sphere. Then maybe the peak day is of interest, too. So, of course, the global average, spherical average, does peak at the expected sort of beginning of June time, but there is, depending on these where these local sample spheres are, what the distributions is within them, quite a scatter about them. So it's easily to get you know, tens of days out of it. In some extreme cases, you can get more. And of course, it rises towards high Vmins, but there I have to caution that I'm really just running out of particles in these sample spheres. So it's hard to determine the modulation there, and I think a lot of this is just an error. So I don't know that I would really believe these flares up at the highest velocities. So you can get to very large modulation fractions if you get far enough out on the tail. In fact, if you're far enough out, you'll just get 100% modulation because you never have enough energy to get any scattering in the winter.
Okay.
Exactly, that would be 100%. So that happens in the Maxwell-Boltzmann case at pretty high velocities, like 750. So, but it can happen at smaller velocities and in these distribution functions that are derived, that are measured in the simulations. You can also look at the arrival time of, sure. No, so that's right. So I haven't looked at it in much detail in this case, but that's also what I mean here. Once you run out of particles, it's also harder to determine like when it's actually the peak actually is occurring. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good suggestion. I haven't looked at that. You can also look at the arrival time, not the arrival time, the arrival directions of photon of dark matter particles. So this is now in the rest frame, and I'm considering all particles, so Vmin of zero. This is in the halo rest frame. So in the Maxwell-Boltzmann, of course, isotropic, so they're coming from all directions equally. If you look at the spherical shell, you can already see departures from that. This is just because the halo as a whole is not isotropic. It tends to be radially biased and close to the center of the halo. So the radial direction towards the galactic center is in the middle and away from the galactic center is on these points. So you can see there's more particles going towards the galactic center than away. Perpendicular to it. Then if you look at individual sample spheres, you can see departures just because there happen to have been either a tidal stream or a subhalo in the sample sphere. So in that case, most of the particles are coming from the particular direction with which the subhalo or tidal stream was going through the sample sphere. So you can get certain differences here. But this is all in the halo rest frame, and so, of course, what's relevant is in the Earth rest frame. So when you translate to the Earth rest frame, you get the hot spot just from the motion of the sun around the galactic center. And then, of course, the modulation would arise from the Earth going around the sun. And so now if I just look at all particles at Vmin of zero, then all these four cases that I showed you before look pretty much identical. It's really hard to see any difference between them. But if you look at higher velocities, so a Vmin of 500, so this would be right in the range that Kojund or so is measuring, then you can start to see some differences in some of these sample spheres. So, for example, here is a pretty extreme case. Due to the presence of some velocity substructure, the direction from which most of the dark matter particles are coming from is quite removed from the direction that would correspond to the motion of the Earth or of the Sun through the galactic halo. And so we can just look at all of our 100 samples and make a plot, a distribution of the difference between the direction the normal hotspot direction and the actual hotspot direction, that's psi here. And I can look at this for all, if I just use all particles, so Vmin of zero, then clearly it's peaked very closely to zero degrees. But if I restrict myself to high velocity particles, then the distribution is shifted to higher angles. And in fact, as I write here, at Vmin of 500 kilometers a second, the hotspot is more than 10 degrees away from the direction of the Earth's motion in 80% of all cases. Right, okay, so that's, you may have heard me talk about this before. These are kind of a few years old results. So now I want to start talking about some stuff that I've been working on more recently. And that this is work that's still a work in progress with Mariangela Lesanti. And we're focusing on what we call debris flow particles. So what do we mean by that? Well, debris flow are particles that were at some point in the past gravitationally bound to a halo or a subhalo. But then as they fell into the host halo, they were stripped off tidally or otherwise. And of course, you might think, oh, okay, that's just a tidal stream like we saw before in that movie. But actually, oftentimes, in fact, as you'll see in this movie here, the material isn't in some like nice, cold tidal stream, but actually instead is just sort of in a form of shells and just sprays and doesn't look very much like a cold tidal stream at all. And it actually can be spatially quite uniformly distributed. So this is so what I've done here in this movie is just follow the orbit of all the particles that were in one particular halo at redshift 2.5, started from here, and then it falls into the host halo, and then you can see the particles are just sloshing about in the gravitational potential, and you can see all kinds of interesting features that what we would call debris flow, not necessarily cold tidal streams. And the distinction is that if you look at 8 kiloparsecs, you're going to see these debris flow particles pretty much no matter where you are at 8 kiloparsecs. They're kind of spatially distributed, either because the structure has been looped on top of each other or because it's just has been sprayed off in all directions, as opposed to a tidal stream, which would be spatially localized and might only appear in like one particular area in the halo. Right, so we're focusing on this debris flow. Mariangelo wrote a paper with David Spergel on this earlier this year, where they were looking at one particular output file in the Via Láctea simulation and tracing forward in time where those particles ended up at redshift zero. So now we're doing this a bit more careful and actually following through all the individual time steps where these particles are coming from, what subhalos they're coming from, and where they deposit material in velocity space at redshift zero in a shell at 8 kiloparsecs. So this is the fraction of particles that are coming from that we call debris particles as a function of Vmin. So going here from 200 out to 700 kilometers per second in the Earth's reference frame. And you can see the fraction of debris particles actually rises to be dominant. So if you're at 500 or so, about half of all particles that we find in this simulation at 8 kiloparsecs actually are these debris particles. So they're not smooth dark matter halo particles, but they're disrupted from subhalos and show significant structure and velocity space. So the particle has to be bound at some earlier time to a subhalo and then no longer be bound to that subhalo, only be bound to the host halo at redshift zero. So it's been stripped. Well, actually, that's not entirely clear in the numerical simulations. You don't actually have 100% affiliation. We've only looked at a sample in which there is still an identifiable remnant at redshift zero. So these are not subhalos that built up the halo completely by being completely disrupted. So they still have a remnant at redshift zero. That's an important point. I should have mentioned that. Here's the velocity distribution that comes out of debris flow that fell in at a given time. So here's material that fell in between redshift 0 and 1, and here between redshift 1 and 5. And this is the overall distribution. So you can see it's nothing like a Maxwellian. It's not peaked at low velocities. It has a pretty high velocity component here, around 300 to 400 kilometers per second. This is on the galactic rest frame. And you can see the distribution from individual subhalos is shown here with these colorful dashed lines. The stuff that's really early accreted does kind of sort of virialize and form some kind of more Maxwellian-looking distribution, but it actually is a very small fraction of particles, as you can see. This is just debris flow particles, exactly. So depending on what velocity you're looking at, it's at the Vmin of 500, half of the particles are at that. So in this plot, I'm just showing the count of all particles that were part of the debris flows, so no matter what velocity they are at redshift zero, because you can see this kind of wide variety. This is in the galactic rest frame, and in the Earth's rest frame, some of the structure, again, is smoothed out, but you can still see there's not all the particles are, the peak of this distribution is not as you expect from Maxwell-Boltzmann at the low velocities, but instead is at high velocities. So this is not all the particles. It is at low velocities. The majority of the particles are not in debris flow, so the overall distribution is still peaked at low velocities, but this debris flow component has a different velocity distribution. Right. We can look at so this is still work in progress, like I said, but we can actually look at these various different halos here and follow them through time. I have very detailed information about them, namely their mass and their Vmax and so on at 27 discrete times, but I followed the particles in between, so I can actually get full orbit information. You can see some of them have undergone multiple pericenter passages. They lose their mass, and so we're in the process of looking in more detail at how this material is stripped off and distributed and where this high-velocity components are coming from. You can also, of course, look at the direction where this material is coming from. So there, again, you're finding some pretty interesting departures from a Maxwell-Boltzmann halo here. This is just the Maxwell-Boltzmann halo realized with 10 million particles. And then, again, just spinning up the direction that particles will be arriving from in the Earth's frame. And now the hotspot direction has been centered here. And I've split this up into different velocity bins. So these are particles that are arriving at Earth with velocities less than 200 kilometers a second, 200 to 350, 350 to 500. And greater than 500 kilometers a second. And this is the Maxwell-Boltzmann case. Here is just for all particles, regardless of whether they're debris flow or not. And you can already see differences here. Some of the distribution in this case is peaked in a slightly different direction. It's also the distribution is wider, not as spatially concentrated. And that's just because these debris flow particles are not behaving as the overall smooth distribution. They have very distinct features like this ring. In this case, you don't see very many particles coming from the direction of the Earth motion at all. They're distributed in this kind of peculiar ring. So when you add it to all the other particles, it results in kind of just a broadening of the distribution. So this is kind of stuff for the very far future, for the intermediate to distant future, once direct detection has become a routine and actually people are doing directionally sensitive direct detection, then this kind of features will be interesting to look for as confirmations of departures from the Maxwell-Boltzmann halo. Right, so those are the first two topics I wanted to talk about. Now I want to move on to talk about the error simulation. So now this is a departure from what I was showing before. This is no longer a purely dark matter simulation. This is one of the first simulations that includes hydrodynamic physics that is able to reproduce a realistic-looking disk galaxy. This has been a challenge for many years in the community, and people are making big progress and are able to now produce realistic-looking disk galaxies in cosmological simulations. I'm actually not directly involved with the group that ran the simulation. This is Javier Guedes, who is a graduate student of Piero Madao, and some collaborators of theirs at Zurich, Lucio Meyer and Simone Caligari. So they recently completed the simulation and have been putting out a few papers describing the properties of the disk that results in it and showing that it actually compares very favorably with the properties of a realistic disk galaxy like our Milky Way galaxy. So other than that, it's the same general approach as we do in Via Láctea. You have a cosmological volume, and you evolve a small region forward in time at very high resolution. But now you have to follow all the additional complicated baryonic physics. And so there's a huge can of worms attached with that. It wouldn't be fair to say that this is the only unique way of solving that problem. They've adopted a particular prescription for how stars form and how supernova feedback affect subsequent star formation, and so this is not a solved problem yet, but at least there is one, disk galaxy that is actually looking very realistic. So why did I mention all this? Because, started looking at the dark matter distribution more closely, we found evidence for a dark disk in this. So the way you go about this is you kinematically select particles. So here's actually just for the star particles. It's hard to see here, but what I'm plotting here is this quantity epsilon, which is the z component of the angular momentum divided by what the circular angular momentum would be. So 1 would be a particle on a completely circular orbit, so that's a disk particle. And then this is just the distribution function of these. And so this is just showing the baryonic components. The blue line is all the stellar particles, and you can see that there's a very strongly peaked here at epsilon of 1. That's just corresponding, showing you that these particles are moving, in fact, in a circular orbit in a disk. But you can do the same kind of decomposition for the dark matter, and this is what it looks like. It's now symmetric. Particles are, in general, going in both directions. They don't care. They have a net angular momentum of zero or close to zero. But there is a component here that you can isolate with a high angular momentum, so high epsilon, close to 1, that corresponds to a dark disk. So if you look at it in projection, you can see here this is the YZ and the XZ projection. This is a component of dark matter that is co-rotating with the disk. Well, it's rotating a bit slower because it has a higher velocity dispersion in the vertical direction, but it has net rotation in the same sense of the spiral of the gas distribution. So this has been seen before. Of course, I should have put references here. I neglected to do that. My apologies. For people that have seen this before, both in isolated simulations in which they've thrown in satellites into a galactic potential that includes a component of a disk, and it's also been seen in some other cosmological simulations. And so the explanation is just that you have a satellite that is falling in. A satellite that's falling in and is being pulled into the galactic plane by dynamical friction because now the potential that is acting on it is not spherically symmetric. There is a essential disk component of potential. So as it gets pulled into the disk and is disrupted, its particles are preferentially deposited in the galactic disk. At least this has been found in these previous works. So we haven't in this simulation gone back and looked at the origin of these particles, which satellite they came from, or if they came from multiple satellites. So far, I've only looked at the properties of the dark disk at redshift zero without looking at the evolution over time. So let's start looking at that. Here's the dense. Oh, yeah, well, I'm going to go through that now. So here's the density profile. So this is now in the disk. So I've oriented the coordinate system in a cylindrical coordinate system. So the radius here refers inside the disk. I'm only looking at particles that are within 0.1 kiloparsecs of the disk. And I'm plotting the density profile as a function of radius. First of all, here, the baryonic component in green here, stars and gas, dominates all of the dark matter inside of 10 kiloparsecs. So this is just to show that, yeah, galactic disks are baryon-dominated in the center. We all knew that before. This this dotted line here is the density, the dark matter density profile you would derive in a way that would in a spherically symmetric way. So again, you're just bidding up particles in spherical shells and calculating what is the density profile. And then the two solid lines here are the total dark matter inside this narrow or thin disk, and then the dark disk component that we have kinematically identified. And so in this range where the Earth is, you say 6 to 10 kiloparsecs, this is a pretty broad range here in order for me to get sufficient particles. But in this range, you can see that the dark disk contributes about 10% of the density profile, of the density, local density. That's the first point to note. It's about a 10%. In this particular simulation, it's about a 10% effect in terms of mass. The other point to note is that the total mass distribution inside the disk actually is higher than the sort of spherical average, and it's higher by about 30%, so a factor of 3 larger than the contribution from the dark disk. So there's additional material in this disk that we haven't kinematically identified as being a dark disk. So that is leading to an additional enhancement of the local dark matter. But it's on the order of 30% in this case. Right, so this is the density distribution. Now we can look at the velocity distributions. Here's just to show that this component is co-rotating with the disks, with the stars in the disk. So I'm showing the three different, in a cylindrical coordinate system, the three different distribution functions, radial, azimuthal, vertical, and then the velocity modulus distribution. This is in the halo rest frame. And so you can see the total dark matter and then the kinematically identified dark disk component here is co-rotating with the stars. But maybe it's actually nicer to drop the stars because then I can rescale this. So now I'm looking at comparing it, instead of comparing to the stars, comparing to what I'm calling a control sample. The control sample is just all particles in a shell at 8 kiloparsecs. So this, irrespective of whether the particles are in a disk or not. And so you can see this dark disk, since it's offset from offset in velocity because it's co-rotating with the disk, gives you an excess here at these at about 200 kilometers a second. This is this little bump here. So it doesn't look like very much when you plot it in the velocity distribution and the velocity modulus distribution in the galactic rest frame. But if you translate to the Earth's rest frame, again here in summer, then you can see that this additional contribution here now leads to an excess at low velocities just because the stars are, of course, moving relatively slowly with respect to this dark disk. So you get this kind of excess here at low velocities. Okay, so this is just the velocity distributions. Now we can look at what does that imply for the total scattering rate and also for the modulation. So just like I was showing before, I've just gone and calculated in 365 days what is the GV min, this integral from V min up to infinity of F of V over V for 365 days in different V min bins. So I can calculate, I get this nice annual this annual modulation in many different V min bins. And then I can just fit a sine to it or a cosine to it and get what is the mean scattering amplitude and what is the modulation amplitude and at what time does the peak occur. And so here I'm just showing the mean season averaged mean scattering rate. So that's A in this notation. So you can see, of course, it drops off as you go to higher Vmin. It's just because you're further out on the tail. And I'm comparing both to the Maxwell-Boltzmann case and then to the control sample. And so you can see there's slight differences. Here I'm plotting the difference. 10% or so difference in the low velocities, you get an excess just because, like I said, there's more particles moving slowly with respect to the dark disk. And then you get a corresponding deficit here in the intermediate velocities. at the high velocities now, you get an excess. I don't think this is due to the presence of the cold dark disk itself. I think this is due to this additional contribution of dark matter particles inside the disk. But I'm still trying to investigate further what this sort of increase is referring to, where it's coming from. But the effects of the dark disk, I think, are these low velocity effects. Right, so I can again compare with the experimental benchmark that I had before. So again, we can see here out at 400 and above is where things are relevant for cogent, and the other experiment scaled to cogent. So you're pretty far away from the dark disk. So you're in this regime here where there is an enhancement of the signal that I found, but it's probably not due to the presence of the dark disk. If you want to have effects that are due to a co-rotating component, you're going to be looking at experiments that have a low V-min threshold. So because they're either sensitive to very high mass dark matter particles or have a correspondingly higher energy threshold. So the modulation then, that's more or less the last thing I wanted to talk about. Now here I'm showing plots of modulation amplitude and then modulation fraction and then the peak day. Again, for these three cases, all dark matter, dark disk, and the control sample. And you can see the differences here. It's maybe a bit hard to see, but these scales go down to like 40 and 40%. But the differences are on the order of 10, 20, to 30% at these low velocities. That's the upshot of the dark disk in this simulation. One curious thing, or one cute little thing I did, was to just take all the azimuthal components of the particles in the dark disk and just flip their sign to sort of mimic a retrograde dark disk. There isn't really any a priori reason why the material that deposited the disk had to fall in with the same direction as the angular momentum as the disk. You could imagine a retrograde orbiting satellite falling in. So in that case, of course, all the particles are shifted to higher velocities with respect to the motion of the sun. And so that just pushes the effect of the dark disk out to higher V-min. And it slightly increases the effects too. You get to maybe more closely to 40% differences with the control sample. Right, so I'll just go through my conclusions. According to ultra-high resolution dark matter-only simulations, the F of V is not strictly a Maxwellian distribution that shows departures both globally and locally. These departures are most noticeable at high velocity, so that makes them very relevant for light dark matter models, or also for inelastic dark matter models, or for experiments that are directionally sensitive, because at the moment these have very high energy, recoil energy thresholds, and so require high velocities to get to those. Velocity substructure can be both spatially localized in the form of subhalos or tidal streams, but it can also be global in these debris flows that I was showing you before. And the debris flow is just non-virialized bulk motions of particles, and it's dominant at high velocities and can have interesting effects in the arrival direction of dark matter. Lastly, it's possible to go beyond pure dark matter simulations of galaxy formation. There's some caveats that I sort of briefly glanced over, so don't take this as the final word, but it's interesting that people are making progress on this now. And of course, it's much lower coarser resolution than what we can achieve with purely cold dark matter simulations, but we can start to learn things about the dark matter distribution in those simulations as well. And the ERA simulation is one example, and it has this kinematically distinct dark disk, which is a component of the dark matter halo rotating in the galactic disk plane, and it has about a 10% effect on the local density and affects the scattering rates and the annual modulation at the 10 to 20% level. So, thank you.
So one comment, I think it does make sense that prograde is favored. If it's dynamical friction, then it's, you know, the slower the stars are moving relative to the dark matter, the more they'll fall in, and, you know, you get a bigger Chandrasekhar effect.
Mm-hmm. Right. So are you suggesting that a subhalo that fell in a retrograde sense wouldn't actually experience the
friction? I think its interaction with the disk would be, I mean, the potential effect is the same, but the dynamical friction effect is...
Are you talking about dynamical friction due to the stars, or due to dark matter?
I think he's talking due to the stars.
The stars are the ones that are sitting in the disk, and so a satellite that comes in phase with the stars is going to perturb the stars more, which would cause more dynamical friction, I think. If that's the effect.
I think that's... Yeah, right. I mean, there's also an additional effect because the dark matter distribution is no longer spherically symmetric either. It also shows some compression. So. But yeah, I think you're right.
But I guess a second question, if dark halos are, I mean, we know they rotate, we know they're triaxial.
Yeah.
you know, how do you distinguish the dark disk from the other particles? I mean, within this thick disk, we have metallicity. You know, if it was just sort of kinematics, you might think it's just one complicated disk distribution. But
and I haven't done this exercise, but if I were to just apply our same sort of kinematic decomposition to, say, the Via Láctea halo, it would not pull out a component like this. It wouldn't be there, even though that is a triaxial halo, a typical sort of dark matter halo. So this is an addition. Another way of saying it is if I just take this like negative angular momentum distribution and just flip it, I get something that looks very much like this blue dashed line. So there's an excess material that has this high JZ over JC.
There was a question?
Don't turn the galaxy into the halo and then just look at the evolution of the spiral galaxy inside the halo. What would be the difference between the darkness in this case, in this scenario?
So I'm not sure I understood completely. You're just growing sort of adiabatically.
Yes, adiabatically you're growing. And we expect to have a dark disk also from this.
So I need to, I'm not 100% sure what the answer to your question is. I don't think you're going to get a very large dark disk component, but I'm pretty sure people have investigated that. I'm just not quite up to speed on what the answer is to your question. I don't think the predominant explanation for the presence of a dark disk is not just sort of an adiabatically growing or compressed dark matter contribution, but actually having been deposited from any fallen satellites.
So regarding the adding the baryonic stuff, pretty complicated messy physics.
Yeah.
Is there any real hope or real plan that at some point we'll have a definitive answer to those questions, or is it what will be, okay, if you assume this, this is what you'll get, if you assume that, that's what you'll get, but there's no way to assume those
things. Well, I think it's kind of early times. I think in the future, I don't think there's anything preventing us from ever getting definite answers, but at the moment there's many, many, many uncertainties, both in, you know, the hydrodynamics, like how it's actually implemented. This is done with an SVH simulation that's a Lagrangian particle code, but other people prefer mesh codes or movable mesh codes. Then there's many, many difficult differences in how you implement star formation and supernova feedback. So at the moment, it's not a unique solution at all. But I think in the future, it can become with better observations and more exploration of the parameters.
So the nice thing about baryons is that you can see them. So
yes.
There are constraints then.
One last question.
Do you know the mass of the thing that produced your dark disk?
No, so that's what I'm saying. We only started analyzing this, so I don't have any idea in this particular simulation where it came from, or if it even only came from one satellite or not. So that's what I'm doing.
I was thinking of, you know, a shortcut around the theoretical uncertainties is also if it's massive enough, then the stellar material associated with it should still be around.
Yeah.
So, for instance, in the Milky Way, there is a feature like this in the outer disk, right, in Monoceros, where there are extra stars, and those may be some object like that.
Right, and there's the Sagittarius tidal stream.
Right, but I'm just thinking of stuff in the disk plane.
Yeah.
Presumably that's a bigger worry than well, Sagittarius, I guess, is a worry because it does go through our location.
Yeah.
But so there's a way of, I guess, ruling out the contribution to this.
Right, so it could